Welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Raj Balkaran. I'm a specialist in Hinduism. You can find out more about me at rajbalkaran.com. It is my pleasure today to be talking with Sucharita Adluri, who is associate professor in the Department of Philosophy and Comparative Religion at Cleveland State University. And today we'll be talking about her book, Textual Authority in Classical Indian Thought, Ramanuja and the Vishnu Purana. But before we get into the book, we should get into the author of the book. So welcome, Sucharita.
Thank you, Raj.
So maybe you can tell us just a little bit about yourself, maybe where you hail from, how you got interested in this. You know, tell us a bit of your story.
Yeah, so I received my master's and PhD in religious studies from University of Pennsylvania. And I had actually gone there to study with Wilhelm Hauptfass, who unfortunately passed away 2 years into my sort of tenure there. And so Ludo Roche then became my main mentor. But while there, I became interested in Sri Vaishnavism, which is a living tradition in South India. It had its beginnings in the 13th centuries. And basically my book is about the beginnings of this tradition. Mm. Reading in graduate school, I came across, works that talked about Ramanuja as a synthesizer of Vedanta philosophy and devotionalism and bhakti. So I asked a very simple question, deceptively simple. In fact, I asked how he did that. How was he able to accomplish that? Mm. So that kind of then led me to this text, the Vishnu Purana, that he uses quite a lot in his in all his commentaries on the Vedanta canon, which are commentaries on the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Brahma Sutras themselves.
Right. So now that we're entering a little bit of the meat of your book, first I want to say, I naively didn't realize that you were mentored by Ludo Roche, and as excited as I was to do this book for a number of reasons, that is super exciting. His survey of the Puranas is like the Bible of the Puranas.
Exactly, yes.
And for those of us who may be a little newer to the terminology, the Puranas is a group of texts that loosely can be thought of as, say, mythological texts, legends, stories. So there's a class of texts in South Asia that contains the various lore that most consider folk and were sort of brutally received by colonial scholars, thinking they were haphazard, interpolated Brahmanical conceits. And now scholars like Sucharita and even myself are realizing the power of the Puranas. I asked this deceptively naive question myself for my doctorate, which essentially the book coming out later this month, which is, why is the Devi Mahatmya framed by a king in exile? Like, why is the story told to a king in exile? What's up with that? And so I get what you're saying about the deceptively naive question of, well, how did Ramanuja accomplish this? Right. Before we get into the meat of the book, here's a question that I think is fascinating and I think apt. Ramanuja is this systematizer, this thinker, this philosopher, right?
Right.
Now, is traditionally in scholarship, or even in traditional Indian paradigms, is that achievement in vain not incongruent, or thought of as incongruent, with looking at the Vishnu Purana or the Puranas or the lore of India for support? Is there something compatible or incompatible about a systematic philosopher looking to narrative?
Absolutely, especially in the context of Vedanta philosophy. Most, if not all, arguments that commentators make in their works on Vedanta refer to Shruti. You referred to Smriti earlier, of which Vishnu Purana is a text of the Puranic genre. Most commentators usually rely on the scriptural scripture of the Upanishads, the Vedas, which are thought to have a higher authority than Smriti. So Ramanuja was, in a sense, the first Vedanta commentator, or at least a commentator whose works are extant, who really sort of infuses Vedanta with these, you know, for lack of a better word, popular texts, Puranic texts like the Vishnu Purana. And he was very biased in his use of Vishnu Purana. He does cite from other Puranas here and there, but the bulk of his arguments are supported by material from the Vishnu Purana.
So it's even interesting to me as a specialist, because I don't, you know, I do very different. I do different work than you. And my work is primarily narratological, ideological, or making sense of the Hindu world through narrative. And your work is very squarely historical. So it's fascinating for me to understand that this notion that we have ample evidence that the tradition looked to the Puranas for systematic thought. And yet we're only now in the last few decades really grokking this notion that if you want to understand Hindu philosophy, you need to understand Hindu narrative, but it's problematic because it's so interpreting, thinking philosophically and thinking narratologically aren't necessarily the same thing. And using stories, sort of being able to understand stories the way we understand facts, there's sort of different aspects of us. So I really like this bridge very much. Why don't you tell our listeners, in a nutshell, what is it your book does? What does it say? What's the core takeaway that it accomplishes?
The main point that it tries to make through its all of the chapters is that, one, that this was a very unique exegetical strategy that was utilized. So it tells us a little bit about, you know, what commentators do with material, or a lot of times there isn't a lot of information on how commentaries are written or should be written, and so what my book does is kind of goes behind the scenes of this commentaries of Ramanuja that we have before us, kind of looking a little bit at the mechanics of how he was able to argue his point of view, while at the same time refuting, you know, objections from, for him, the rival tradition was Advaita Vedanta of Shankara. So in that sense, I think it tells us a lot about commentary writing. It tells us a lot about texts. How were texts viewed? This Vishnu Purana, which is a, you know, approximately a 4th century text, how did it transform the sort of the doctrine, philosophy, religious expression of 12th century South India?
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating. That's very rich. Maybe tell our readers briefly what sources you used, or what was your data? Like, what did you look at?
Right. So the sources that I utilize are three of Ramanuja's main commentaries. One is the Vedartha Sangraha, which is his commentary on all the Upanishads. Ramanuja did not write commentaries on individual Upanishads like Shankara did. So the Vedartha Sangraha and his commentary on the Brahma Sutras, and also the Bhagavad Gita. So these three are considered to be to kind of comprise the Vedanta canon, and writing commentaries on these texts sort of legitimated one as a commentator in Vedanta circles in medieval times. So the source texts are these three texts, and I then in the text explore his use of Vishnu Purana, where he uses it and how he uses it. So it requires a little bit of, it's not just about the quotations, it's about how those Vishnu Purana quotations actually aid in his argument.
And just to be clear, the quotations, he quotes the Vishnu Purana in these commentaries themselves.
That's correct, yes. And we can find actually these quotations in the critical edition of the Vishnu Purana that has been published 1990, I think, by Peter Schreiner. So at least by the 12th century, the Vishnu Purana as we have today is the same as the text that we have today. So this is not a question of him, making up quotations or that we can't find the quotations in our editions of the Vishnu Purana, so on and so forth. So
would you, in your opinion, do you find that his reading of the Vishnu Purana is relatively true to the Purana as someone may read it outside of that context, or do you find that it's somewhat strained for the sake of his theological bent?
Right. And this is a very, very important question, because it kind of goes directly to, it addresses directly how we view texts. It seems to me from, working with these commentaries and, the use of the Vishnu Purana, that Puranas in some sense were not sort of read in and of themselves. Sure, there were performances, there were recitations of the Puranas that took place in temples and other public arenas, but I think always there was a sort of a dependence on some kind of a commentary, whether it was a written commentary, as in the case of Ramanuja, or oral commentaries. So I think it's, if you look at the Vishnu Purana itself, I think you can find both Advaita and Vishishtadvaita interpretations of views of ultimate reality and Vishnu, but it's in the hands of a master exegete like Ramanuja, I think he's able to successfully read the Vishnu Purana first through the lens of his self-body framework. And then use these Puranic verses to actually read some of the Shruti texts themselves. Mm. So this is all interpretation, and it's difficult to say, is the Vishnu Purana Advaitic or Vishishtadvaitic or Dvaita? Mm. It's written from a Dvaita perspective. I think the text is fluid enough overall, right, that any of the above frameworks can be had from it.
So this resonates with my understanding of the Puranas, although I think of it in the inverse, whereas my sense is that the very genre of Puranas and the epics, they function to sew together these various strands. So they function in the popular culture to uphold ideologies that come from these various sectarian or philosophical strands. And so narrative is the most powerful way to unite contradiction or play with tensions or preserve tensions. And it seems to me that the Puranas purposefully bring together various ideas as only narrative can. And so the fact that different exegetes from different traditions can now distill that, kind of reverse engineer.
Right, absolutely, yes.
The project of the Puranas, it's very fascinating to me. I wonder,
as a lead up to the answer to the question that you just asked about, is the Vishnu Purana Advaitic or Vishishtadvaitic? One example this comes up in chapter 3 on his, in his commentary, the Sribhashya, Ramanuja purposefully has the Advaitin objector cite the Vishnu Purana to establish the Advaita point of view. And then in his conclusion, the Siddhanta, he goes on to refute it. So this strategy, right? So he's not choosing a text simply because it serves his purpose. He's almost reclaiming the Vishnu Purana as a Vishishtadvaitic text. This is very, it's a wonderful strategy where he's very upfront in having the objector use it you know, to support his views, and then sort of, you know, take it all back in his you know, argument against why the Vishnu Purana shouldn't be read that way.
So. No, it is fascinating. Tell us, I mean, there's so much we could have an entire podcast on just reading texts or texts in South Asia and the symbiosis between ideology and narrative, which is sort of where I live. But let's go more into the heart of your findings and maybe unpack for our listeners, you know, what does the Vishnu Purana affirm for him in terms of his conceptions of self?
Right.
So what are the concepts that he really
affirms? So, yeah, so there are several sort of strands or themes running through all of my chapters, and the Vishnu and these themes are concerns of Ramanuja, because they're sort of unique features of Vishishta Advaita Vedanta, and in all the, for all these features, then he depends on the Vishnu Purana. So first, Ramanuja was very sort of intent on claiming and affirming Brahman as the cause of the world, right? As the material cause of the world. So to put this in perspective, he was responding to the Advaita point of view, right? That the world is illusion, right? It's a cognition, right? That can be corrected, so to speak, with right knowledge, right? So for Ramanuja, who's coming from a very sort of a devotional Sri Vaishnava context, temple worship, the image in the temple, devotion and popular devotional practices were very important. And so for him, arguing that the material world is real, but at the same time is a product of Brahman or Vishnu was very important. So that's one point for which he depends heavily on the Vishnu Purana. The second point is to distinguish, again, this goes back to Advaita commentaries. He was very keen to establish the distinction between the individual self and Brahman. So in Advaita, individual, when you have the right understanding or realization, there is no distinction of individual self and Brahman. For Ramanuja, even when you're liberated, that distinction is maintained because Vishnu as the supreme deity, right, sort of rules over liberated souls who are ever in sort of adoration and worship of him. Right, so even in liberation, that distinction is not erased. So that's the second important point. The third important point for which he depends on the Vishnu Purana is in his definition of ignorance or avidya, and how that affects the embodiment of the individual self. So consistently, if you look at the three commentaries, it is these points, right, on which he goes to the Vishnu Purana for support, right? And the Vishnu Purana is able to provide Ramanuja through his reading, right, of the Vishnu Purana, these support for these arguments. So the main features of Vishishta Advaita Vedanta are, if you look in his commentaries, are firmly indebted in some sense to the Vishnu Purana passages and Ramanuja's reading of the Vishnu Purana.
That is fascinating material. Is there anything that surprised you when you were coming across this material and drafting this book or looking at the sources? Is there something in particular that really threw you for a loop or you know, you may have wished you had known going in, or tell us what surprised you about this?
Yeah. I was very naive at first, thinking that I would just have to sort of evaluate and analyze, right, Ramanuja's commentaries, right, and look at his citations on the Vishnu Purana, and then you know, conclude, right, how the Vishnu Purana helps him, doesn't help him, vis-a-vis other sources, other sources such as the Upanishad. What I found was that in order for me to fully understand what Ramanuja was, how he was using the Vishnu Purana, I had to actually look at Advaita commentaries as well on some of these topics that, you know, that use the Vishnu Purana. So it kind of expanded my research, sort of the data I needed to collect, the sources were increased. Not only that, I also had to look at commentaries on Ramanuja's commentaries, so sub-commentaries by his disciples, just to make sure that I stayed within the tradition. Not that I should be, but I wanted to make sure that the way I thought Ramanuja was interpreting the Vishnu Purana was in line with later Sri Vaishnava tradition. And I wanted to make a note of if I was or wasn't, right? And why the case may be, but I really kind of wanted to document that. So that kind of expanded the project in surprising ways. It was a lot of work, but also very rewarding. So
much like Ramanuja himself, you had to understand, fully understand the opponent's point of view.
Yeah, and this takes us back to what we started our conversation with, is this whole idea of intertextuality and how texts are sort of woven together. And in order to understand a text, it's important to look at the textual context, the interpretive communities that are involved in you know, composing these commentaries.
So, Now, for the listener's benefit, just a tiny bit of context. I had not met Sucharita before, but by some stroke of luck, we were both at the World Sanskrit Conference. It takes place every 3 years, often in exotic places. Like 3 years ago, it was in Bangkok. We were lucky in that it was in our backyard. It was in Vancouver. It was the 8th to 13th, so she hand-delivered her book to me, and there was lots of presentations about intertextuality in the Purana. So yes. This is a fascinating, new, exciting avenue of research for all of us. Now, tell me then, do you feel that, now you're looking at the commentaries of Ramanuja's commentaries on behalf of his disciples, do you feel that there was any disjunction or any, was there cohesion there, or did you feel that various disciples were pulling in different directions, or what was your sense of that?
His immediate disciples, the works of his immediate disciples, seem to sort of expand on his sort of argument. So I think by the time of his disciples, there were other Advaita treatises that were composed that you know, had refuted Vishishta Advaita doctrines. So his disciples then had to contend with these later Advaita commentaries as well to address the issues against Vishishta Advaita that were raised, you know, in the rival commentaries. So in that sense, I think they have to deal with newer material in some sense. On the other hand, they always claim, as exegetes do, that they are following Ramanuja, right? But they're making what he had said clearer, you know, to our understanding. So,
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So there's various pieces. Tell us, what was your favorite chapter? What was your favorite piece writing? What was the piece that you kind of, that sung for you, that you really like to get out there?
I think there's several, but I think the third chapter, the third chapter on Sribhashya, Sribhashya 111, which is his commentary on Brahma Sutra 111, is fascinating because I had not expected, you know, Ramanuja to have the Advaitin utilize the Vishnu Purana, you know, up front, and then sort of go on to refute that understanding. So it was very delightful to see that kind of strategy. Now, you know that in South Asian commentarial tradition, there are no texts, at least in the Hindu tradition, that lay out how a commentary should be written, what the rules are. So when I was reading through this, it was wonderful to discover some of these sort of strategies of interpretation, you know, that were utilized by you know, someone in the 12th century. So
So where do you see this research taking you, Sujatha? What do you see is perhaps the an evolute of it, or the next step, or the next question? Or tell us more about where might one build on this, or where might even you plan to build on this?
Right. So this research has opened up several avenues for me. One avenue that I'm pursuing is looking at the Vishnu Purana itself. Not as a text, but the life of Vishnu Purana. And what I mean by that is I'm working on two commentaries on the Vishnu Purana, one written from an Advaita perspective and the other written from a Vishishtadvaita perspective, both written after Ramanuja. One, the Vishishtadvaita commentary is from the 13th century, and the Advaita commentary on the Vishnu Purana is from the 14th, 15th century. So I'm interested in how the Vishnu Purana kind of takes on a life of its own in these commentaries. You know, not the text itself on its own, but how it is transformed in the hands of these two commentators.
So just to be clear for our listeners, you're referring to the textual, so the subsequent textual life of the Vishnu Purana.
Absolutely, yes. Right. It's interpretive mode. Yes.
The reason I ask is because, for example, are you familiar with the work of McComas Taylor, for example?
Absolutely, yes.
And so he's looking at the Bhagavata Purana, but the performative life thereof.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're looking at is the subsequent textual life.
Absolutely,
of the Vishnu Purana, just to be clear.
Right. Okay. And the thing is that these are not simply texts. I mean, they're texts, but they're also embedded in you know, a social cultural context. Mm. So it would be interesting to see how that 200-year difference between the Vishishtadvaita and Advaita, you know, when they were written, what effect that would have had on, you know, how the Vishnu Purana was interpreted.
This brings us to a really fascinating, important observation, I think, about Indian civilization, you know, Indian culture as a whole. This idea of, I don't know even, there's so many pieces, where do I start? So just this idea of the fluidity of the Puranas, that this is a really important idea, that the Vedic corpus is fixed. It's all about precise ritual enunciation, etc. And that the Puranas, as argued by various scholars, that they are the class of text itself serves to fill this need for fluidity and engagement and rolling with the times, right? And so does that resonate with you in terms of the function of the Puranas?
Yes, absolutely. I think what the Vishnu Purana means to someone who's coming from a Vishishtadvaita perspective, as opposed to somebody coming from an Advaita perspective, is very different. And even within Vishishtadvaita and Advaita, there are a lot of permutations, right? I mean, there is a history of Vishishtadvaita philosophy, and there's a history of Advaita philosophy. So it becomes important how at a specific time and place, you know, utilizing a specific framework, whether it's Advaita or Vishishtadvaita, how these texts were sort of you know, mined to give authority to the religious tradition that was commenting on the Vishnu Purana or on these texts.
And so so one concept we use in religious studies is emic versus etic, and emic being the insider's perspective as a devotee of Vishnu or as an intellectual adherent to Advaita Vedanta, for example,
right,
versus what we do in scholarship, the etic perspective, which is what can we understand from outside the tradition. And they're not necessarily hard and fast, mutually exclusive. The emic position is going to inform the Vedic position. So the data of religion itself is not just the hard data, it's also what people believe about the data. It's also how they relate to the data.
Absolutely.
And so this idea that the Vishnu Purana can be both, can serve to what's the word, authorize, serve to authorize, legitimize these various traditions.
Yeah.
How could it be any other way? Because both of these traditions are legitimized within the one tradition that legitimizes the Vishnu Purana. And so insofar as the Vishnu Purana's job is to legitimize the Hindu religious tradition, right? It's going to speak to these various strands. So in a sense, it seems to me that the wisest approach to the text is one of this text is going to be saying different things at different times because the tradition does. And so, yes, you can, as an Advaita Vedantin, see this text through the Advaita Vedanta lens, but I think the bird's eye view is one that the text is itself lending itself to interpretation, if that makes any sense.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So cool. So the life of the text is something you want to explore. And I kind of felt that you had something else you wanted to say. Other offshoots or other developments of the research?
I mean, I'm also working on other projects on Sri Vaishnavism, looking at the religious expression in Sri Vaishnavism. So I'm working on a paper on inscriptions at a Sri Vaishnava center from the 15th century.
What actually got you, why Sri Vaishnavism? What was the draw there?
I think I was looking for a alternative to Advaita Vedanta. I don't mean to say that I understood Advaita so well that I found it, that I didn't find it persuasive. But I wanted to know how, from within the tradition, how the tradition had responded to something so radical as Advaita Vedanta. The world is an illusion. And then the question is, well, what happens with all the ritual, worship, devotion, right? So I think it was kind of my investigation into that that led me to.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that. I think either consciously or unconsciously, part of my draw for the Devi Mahatmya and this text is because, you know, it's narrative. But it's also deeply philosophical when you back the narrative, and it's basically the job of people like me to do so.
Right.
But the overarching thrust of it, I think, counters this classical Hindu Upanishadic notion that the world is a trap, and then the orientation of the wise person is to get the heck out of it.
Right.
Because,
right.
You know, why would you want to be? Who cares how comfortable the cage is? You want freedom, and this sort of. One can make the argument that, yeah, you know, classical Hinduism has no platform for social activism because of this moksha, liberation-oriented bent. And then the pendulum can swing the other way. And you can make the argument that, no, the Puranic narratives, the epics themselves, the Devi Mahatmya, are so squarely about kingship and world affirmation and life in the world that somehow the natural... The pendulum sways from the Vedic world affirmation to the Upanishadic... you know, escaping the world, now back to this narrative where you need to embrace the multiplicity of life.
Right, right. And that actually also, it's a very important point that underscores this sort of plurality of interpretations that is sort of inherent, right, in Hindu traditions of South Asia, where you can have an Advaita perspective, but a Vishishta Advaita and Advaita perspective as well. So it kind of creates, a lot of variety.
Yeah, and if when I teach Hinduism or even when I think about Hinduism, I remind myself that the most fruitful way is to compartmentalize, to think prospectively and provisionally, and that if you're looking for is Hinduism polytheistic, is Hinduism monotheistic, it's this myriad of various traditions that somehow tacitly coexist, and I think that that coexistence is best enacted and preserved in narratives like the Vishnu Purana. So it's no doubt that you wisely are looking to even Ramanuja's use of the Vishnu Purana. So quite enjoyed this work. I think it's important for obvious reasons based on this conversation. We have taken up, I believe, enough of your time for one day. is there anything else do you want to tell us? You've already told us what you're working on, which is great. Is there anything else you want to say to our listeners in terms of where you're at or how to find you or all that?
No, not really. I mean, everything's available online. Information.
No problem. Okay, so it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Raj.
My pleasure. And we will look forward to more exciting Hindu studies works unpacked on here on the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. Until then, take good care. Bye-bye.